apologize that I kept you waiting. And I'm glad I have my glasses. In September 1969, the 11th World Congress on Rehabilitation issued a proclamation designating the 1970s as the decade of rehabilitation. It said in order to awaken increased public interest in the growing problems of disability and in the economic and social advantages of solving them, to urge governments to give a higher priority to programs to prevent disability and the rehabilitation of the disabled, to provide in planning, developing, and delivering rehabilitation services needed by at least 2 out of 3 countries, to increase in volume and accelerate and pace training programs for professional auxiliary personnel needed to man the greatest number of rehabilitation facilities required, and to develop simplified methods and procedures in cooperation with responsible professional organizations so that more rehabilitation services are available within the resources of each country. Actually, this proclaimed decade of rehabilitation was ushering in the second half century of international rehabilitation efforts, because it was in 1919 that the International Labour Organization got organized. And by the way, it might be of interest that it was just at the very same time, since I do come from the United States, that rehabilitation as a national endeavor was born in the United States with the passage in June 1920 of Public Law 236 in the 66th Congress. Now, unfortunately, there's no time here tonight to trace in detail the all-too-slow growth of the rehabilitation movement. But one milestone must be mentioned, because it produced a document that is still of great significance today, and that is the justly famous Recommendation 99, adopted in June 1955 by the General Conference of the International Labour Organization, and entitled Recommendations Concerning Vocational Rehabilitation of the Disabled, pointing out that to meet the employment needs of the individual disabled person and to use manpower resources to the best advantages, it is necessary to develop and restore the working ability of disabled persons by combining into one continuous and coordinated process medical, psychological, social, educational, vocational guidance, vocational training and placement services, including follow-up. The recommendation addressed itself both to physical and mental impairment and said that vocational rehabilitation services should be made available to all disabled persons, whatever their age, provided they can be prepared for and have reasonable prospect of securing and retaining suitable employment. You will note here this last limiting clause of employability.
You see, what needs to be kept in mind is that the origins of rehabilitation were addressed to rather specific population groups, namely workmen in the large industrial establishments, disabled veterans, and in some countries, disabled seamen of the merchant marine. Rehabilitation was very narrowly vocational oriented. Its purpose was to restore these individuals to working capacity. Only very gradually has there been a widening of the scope to other members of the working force. And of course, we need to be mindful that universally, in country after country, one of the most essential workers in our society, the housewife, was never considered in any way related to that working force until the most recent past. housewives became entitled to rehabilitation services only, and these benefits were made available to individuals who had not been previously employed. Furthermore, there has been a slow moving away from numerous restrictive clauses, which of course differed from country to country, and can be referred to here only in a general way. Most notable among those excluded from rehabilitation on the basis of such restrictive clauses were mentally retarded persons,
persons with mental illness,
and altogether people with severe disabilities who could not adjust themselves readily to the requirements of the rehabilitation program. I regret there is no time to refer in more detail to the specific provisions of Recommendation 99, covering principles and methods of vocational guidance and training placements and methods of enabling disabled persons to make use of vocational rehabilitation services. Cooperation between technical services and vocational rehabilitation, children employment, etc. But I do want to stress that the resolution also expressed this resolution 99 concern with close cooperation between the authorities responsible for education and for vocational rehabilitation. With the increasing attention paid to developmental disabled children, this section 9 of recommendation 99, dealing with specific provisions for disabled children and young persons, would serve as a good guide in many countries who are still far away from what the International Labor Organization set forth already 20 years ago. It's quite amazing for somebody who travels about, has contact with governments, how little contact there has been through the years between education and the vocational rehabilitation, and in some countries even between special education and vocational education. If I may summarize significant developments in rehabilitation in more recent years, I would point out the following. One, efforts for early case finding and early rehabilitation, since this would prevent unnecessary deterioration and consequently more complicated, more expensive rehabilitation measures. Two, the inclusion of severely and multiply handicapped individuals. And three, a greater role for the client in the planning and realization of his rehabilitation. It might be of particular interest to this audience to hear about methods of sheltered employment. Sheltered workshops in North America tend to be fairly small operations, and very often this limits the choice of work projects they can undertake. In Europe, and again I generalize, in European countries, they tend to be considerably larger and have more the appearance of factories. And you might be interested, one of the newest structure workshops, located near Rotterdam, serves no less than 1,200 people who are involved in major manufacture of steel doors and locks and furniture in large quantities. There's a special section for disabled white-collar workers who do statistical and computer work on contract. And finally, this is Holland, a separate section for mentally handicapped individuals who produce TV sets and assemble electrical components. And in that one place, 40% of TV sets used in Holland are being manufactured. Basic for the development of such large workshop complexes has been the Dutch Social Employment Act of 1969, which mandates that the local communities identify the disabled and arrange for suitable work program, with the stipulation that nobody in a workshop may be paid less than the minimum industrial wage set by the government. However, after a prolonged period of full-time training, a disabled person's productivity is still below one-third of normal work expectation. Then he will be placed in the day center
which, like those in North America, have more social and educational training components, along with some occupational activities. While the size of the Dutch workshops represents a distinct advantage compared to the situation prevailing in North America, one wonders why not more effort is made to place people with a high productivity level in the open industry. The Dutch obviously are conservative and tend towards segregation.
Enlightened, though it may be,
when it comes to the rendering of services. And this applies also to the school system. On the other hand, I would like to stress that
North American schools might do well to copy
the Dutch school's policy of introducing handicapped pupils at a much earlier age to manual work activities and to eventual pre-vocational training, because this has been one of my particular
criticisms of our educational system of handicapped
individuals.
Another European country where one finds rehabilitation factories
rather than smaller rehabilitation workshops is Poland,
where the semi-governmental Union of Invalids Cooperative
has sizable manufacturing establishments all over the country. When we were in Poland 10 years ago already,
mentally retarded people and mentally ill
people were just beginning to be incorporated into this factory scheme,
originally developed
for the war injured, of which, of course,
Poland had a particularly large
segment of the population.
The factories function
on the basis of the state having set aside for them
a definite section of its national
production.
In a state-controlled economy such as Poland, provisions for social programs
are, of course, more easily accomplished.
This was also true in Yugoslavia, where we visited near Belgrade, a school for mentally handicapped children,
where the entire eighth grade
was assigned to workstation in a large knitting mill.
And during an initial period, they spent
one-third of this year in eighth grade
In the factory, two-thirds of the school.
The following period,
about 3-4 months, this
division was reversed. And in the final stage, they spent
full time at the factory, working side by side
with the regular non-handicapped workers.
And this meant that when they graduated
from school
and reached what was then the
working age in Yugoslavia, and I will admit that most likely
the
school age has been moved up a little bit more,
but at that time that was the working age,
they were far better prepared for employment than
the graduates of special education
in North America. Sheltered
employment in rural areas
has long been recognized as a problem.
I just thought that you might be interested that
Ireland more recently has tried to develop regional workshops
in small provincial towns
to which trainees are transported in minibuses
from a radius of 25 miles.
However,
there are also some efforts made to create sheltered employment
of agriculture or horticultural nature
adjusted to today's marketing conditions.
Some of you may recall that for a while we turned completely away
from the agricultural field and felt
this was not at all a basis
for rehabilitation efforts. But
this is changing in a good number of countries.
I know also in Canada and in the United States,
we're beginning to experiment with some new
type of work activities
for all sorts of disabled people
in the
rural area in connection with horticulture or agriculture or
other as such activities.
So far, I have commented on developments
in countries whose general industrial status
is not too different from that in North America.
Several trips to South America have brought us face to face
with the very difficult problems in rehabilitation planning there. Brazil and Argentina, for instance, as the two largest and most prosperous nations, have in their metropolitan areas some quite well-developed rehabilitation programs, especially for the physically handicapped.
I don't know how many of you have been in Sao Paulo. My only impression of Sao Paulo is that I never quite know, am I there or am I in Chicago? Although with 7.5 million people, the city actually is, of course, vastly larger than Chicago, but its facilities and so on are overwhelmingly metropolitan. But as one moves to the north in Brazil
and to the south in Argentina, one comes
into large areas where there's vast unemployment
and where schooling
may be limited to 2 years total school attendance and seldom exceed 5 years in those
outlying rural areas.
To mount large-scale rehabilitation programs
under such minimal conditions
is obviously impossible.
The one positive factor in this whole situation
in favor of the handicapped
individual is the family
cohesion which provides disabled individuals
with some life support
from the extended family group. But it is really hard to
visualize
this rough division between the affluence of Sao Paulo and its very excellent facilities, and then this desert in north
Brazil.
For the same reasons, rehabilitation planning in the African countries
is still in its very initial stages,
searching for new approaches more in keeping with cultural as well as economic conditions.
At a recent international seminar on children employment, the rehabilitation expert of the International Labour Office
reported on success that had been achieved in resettling disabled men and their families who had lived as beggars at some small working commune in a rural area. The ILA rehabilitation program, ILO, pardon me, rehabilitation program is giving a high priority to the development of rural rehabilitation programs in third world countries aimed at integrating the disabled into their village community. However, at best, these will be very
small pilot programs with
no indication at the moment whence the money will be forthcoming to translate these pilot efforts into large-scale state or community-supported programs. This is indeed a dismal picture, one that could be paralleled by a discussion of the provisions of health service, of course, also in those countries. At the same time, these developing countries are members of the United Nations and all its specialized agencies, and they continuously reach out for assistance with
human services programs, such as those in rehabilitation,
adapted to their own situation. Indeed, some staff members of the international agencies are hopeful that from some of these developing countries, there may come suggestions for innovative programming that might bring new directions to established service systems in industrial countries. In 1969, the World Health Organization's Expert Committee defined rehabilitation as follows. As applied to disability, rehabilitation is a combined and coordinated use of medical, social, educational, and vocational measures for training and retraining the individual to the highest possible level of functioning ability. A vastly expanded definition as compared to what was anticipated
in the earlier years of
the United Nations organization. In other words, rehabilitation
is a team effort, both with regard to the individual client
and to the organization of service programs. Much has been written about the development of the processes of cooperation communication, without which effective coordination is not possible. The problem, of course, once again,
is one of lacking resources in the developing countries,
but also in the sparsely populated areas of industrial countries. Yet, developing countries may have the advantage that they can build into their newly developing professional training programs from the very beginning an emphasis on interprofessional, interdisciplinary communication, an emphasis on the sharing of responsibility rather than on narrow, hierarchical, preferential statuses and prerogatives, which of course characterize our interprofessional relationship. In short, one would hope the developing countries could avoid duplicating the interprofessional rivalries and concerns with priority status with which we are burdened.
Quite frankly, it is for this reason
that I look with much skepticism towards the training of workers from developing countries at our universities, where they most likely will pick up the wrong signals from our long-established patterns of professionalization and professional rivalry. If the need of coordination is difficult at the community level, it is much more complicated at the national level, because their cooperative action and efforts to facilitate communication depend on the interest, often approval by the heads of various ministries, such as labor, education, public mental health, social welfare, etc., whose major responsibilities are far removed from the problems of the disabled, a group which typically lacks the political influence which is meaningful to high governmental officials. Because handicapped individuals, for obvious reasons, have traditionally had difficulties in forcefully representing their own case, voluntary organizations have developed who speak for them, but more recently, the disabled themselves have begun to organize. In ministerial language, this tends to be characterized as outside meddling.
To counter these problems,
there has been an effort in many countries to establish a national rehabilitation commission bringing together both public and private service agencies and representatives of consumer organizations,
and increasingly including disabled people themselves.
A comparative study of the composition of these many commissions, the method of selecting the members, their own internal functioning, and their effectiveness
in terms of the governmental process would be a most
interesting assignment for a graduate student. But for obvious reasons,
this is beyond the scope of our discussion this evening.
Furthermore, this audience will have, from the Canadian viewpoint in any case, an appreciation of the problems faced in constructing
a basis for sound interplay between
local, provincial, and federal operating funding and regulatory bodies.
Therefore, I would like to devote some time
to the agency picture on the international scene. With the Organization of the United Nations and specialized agencies,
ILO, the International Labor Organization,
was joined by other agencies in a unit established within the United Nations itself,
known as the Rehabilitation Unit for the Disabled
in the Social Development Division of the United Nations. Then there was the World Health Organization, which in its mental health unit was particularly interested in rehabilitation of mentally disabled, both mentally ill, mentally retarded, whereas UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, only after considerable prodding by various member nations, finally in the late 1960s recognized its responsibility towards mentally disabled individuals. It is very interesting that the International Educational Organization was just as slow to recognize its responsibility towards the disabled as the various national ministries have been in their respective countries. It's also interesting that the International Organization of Teachers, the World Federation of Teachers, had long a special section of physical education teachers and of art teachers before they finally, just a few years ago, for the first time, developed a group of special education teachers concerned with the education of handicapped individuals.
Rather interesting to see how far prejudice
goes, how far it reaches, and how much it interferes with normal developments. Finally, the UNICEF, the International Children's Fund, likewise was loath to include
mentally handicapped
individuals into its helping programs, and still does very little in this
regard. And finally, United Nations The final United Nations agency that needs to be mentioned here is FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization,
because of the recent overwhelming scientific evidence
that has been presented in recent years concerning the relationship
between nutritional deprivation and handicapping conditions, particularly in the developmental period. And then, of course, the grim reminder that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is still faced with a considerable problem in the area of rehabilitation of handicapped people.
Those of you who struggle
on the state or even local level with coordination of the whole gamut of rehabilitation agencies will readily appreciate
the immense problem of coordinating
the rehabilitation work of these international organizations with headquarters in New York, Paris, Geneva, and Rome. Fortunately, this is facilitated through an ad hoc interagency meeting on rehabilitation of the disabled, which brings together annually
all these rehabilitation components of these agencies
in Geneva. The proceedings of this ad hoc committee provide
valuable information on international developments,
and in recent years have increasingly
included references also
to the needs of the mentally retarded individuals
who have played a much minor role earlier.
At this time, it might be appropriate
to shift from the consideration of the role of the
United Nations and its specialized agencies to the role of the voluntary associations, or in United Nations parlance, the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations. The resolution
passed in 1950 by the United Nations General Assembly,
which led to the establishment of the rehabilitation program within the UN itself, requested the Secretary General to plan this activity jointly
with the specialized agencies
and in consultation with the interested non-governmental organizations. A meeting of such organizations was called and resulted in 1953 in the formation of the Council of World Organizations Interested in the Handicapped, also known as CWOIH, C-W-O-I-H. And CWOIH now comprises almost 40 international voluntary organizations, from the International Committee of the Red Cross to the World Federation of the Deaf and the World Council for the Blind, from the International Catholic Child Bureau to the Salvation Army. A major force from the beginning was the International Society for the Rehabilitation of the Disabled,
now also known as Rehabilitation International.
The organizer of the World Congress of Rehabilitation, which meets every 3 years, Mr. Norman Acton, the Secretary General of the Society, is the present chairman of CWOIH.
For some strange reason, the field of
epilepsy is not represented on the Council of the World Organization Interested in Handicapped. More recently, there, for the first time, has developed an international organization field of cerebral palsy. And this field is now covered much better. I merely want to mention that a member of CWOIH since 1966 is the International League of Societies for the Mentally Handicapped, because the place of that organization, the field of international rehabilitation effort, will be dealt with peripherally by my wife in the public lecture next Thursday
noon here at the
university. Well, this is a long story, but it implies that the force that is developing internationally with regard to the field of rehabilitation.
And some of you
may say, well, really, what significance does all of this have? And what significance, for instance, does it have that most recently, just a month ago, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a new declaration on the rights of disabled persons, and it can safely be stated that it was due to to the strong and persistent backing of the Council of Road Organizations, Interest in the Handicap, which has given to the UN and TAC committee this backing, and to the pressure on their own national UN delegations of the national members of CORI. And I'd just like to mention to you a very interesting byplay. You see, one way of moving your national department is to put an international pressure. High officials in government love to travel internationally. They love to appear at international conferences, and they love to make big speeches there and point to the achievements of their plans. And what you need to do is carefully listen and then confront them again back home with what they said they were doing and what was said they're promising. And so you have a back and forth which really, in a seesaw fashion, moves us ahead. And so this new declaration of the United Nations, Declaration on the Rights of the Disabled Person, which moves us a good bit farther. It mentions some things we have not said before, some new concepts. The disabled person has the inherent right to respect for their human dignity. Question of their right to representation and matters of this nature. I don't want the time. Take the time to read this all. Such a declaration was voted on by, for instance, your own government, undoubtedly. It's very hard for them to disown at home a statement which they have solemnly made in an international body. And so I really want to point out to you that working on behalf of international organizations, as many of us do, is not just an enlightened interest in helping other nations, but it is an enlightened self-interest, because through the international organizations, you can move ahead on your own. And 1975 has indeed been a banner year internationally for the handicapped. Because earlier last summer, the International Labour Congress passed a strong resolution exhorting its member states to pursue rehabilitation programs with greater vigor. And that, you see, is an organization to which your Labour Department listens much more carefully. They're not too interested in what the UN has to say. And earlier, also that year, just a month in last year, a month earlier, the World Health Organization passed a resolution which urged greater activity on behalf of mentally retarded people specifically and called on the Director General to prepare a report on its own accelerated program in the field of mental retardation for the next World Organization. Having presented to you in a rather compressed way some facts of the origin of international rehabilitation work, some comments on the broadening of the rehabilitation program from the original narrow vocational orientation and its organizational aspects on the community, national, international scene, I would now like to turn to some new developments in the philosophical underpinning of today's rehabilitation efforts. Time constraint requires me to limit myself to one major trend, and the one I have chosen is the ever more widely recognized normalization principle. It was first formulated in the English language by Bengt Myrja, who has long been active in the Swedish mental retardation movement, and who since 1970 has been working for the mental retardation services of the province of Ontario. To him, the normalization principle means making available to the disabled patterns and conditions of everyday life which are as close as possible to the norms and patterns of the mainstream of society. And whether they are mildly or profoundly handicapped, whether they live in their own homes or group homes, normalization means sharing a normal rhythm of the day, a normal routine of the week, including work and leisure time and the opportunity to undergo the normal developmental experience of the life cycle. Now, for those of you who may feel that this represents a lot of work, the definition by a prominent daily newspaper, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in an editorial may be more appealing. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette says, by the way, that was in reference to some mental retardation developments, normalization means to ensure for every mentally retarded person and his family the right to live a life as close as possible to that which is typical for the general population. However, no matter what definition is used, normalization is suspect, no doubt about it. And in any gathering of persons concerned with rehabilitation and other human services, the mere mention of the term will produce argumentation and raise blood pressure, particularly on the part of those with physical disability. This represents a most peculiar switch. Undeniably, in the past, there has been a distinct unwillingness on the part of organizations dealing with physical disability to become involved with mental retardation, mental disability, because it was felt that these people deviated so far from the normal that it would distort and damage the public image of physical disability to be identified with them. But now, when from within the field of mental retardation is one product of a veritable avalanche of progress and change, there comes the normalization principle. Some of the same sources from the physical disability field insist almost indignantly that normalization of, for us, it is inappropriate and unrealistic for a person with physical disability. I shall not attempt within the framework of my presentation to present a detailed account of the philosophical base and rationale of the concept of normalization. Let me just point out that the origin of the effort to introduce the concept of normalization was the realization that a specific strategy had to be developed to counteract the process of denormalization, which over the past 75 years made such deep inroads into society's stance, society's dealing with the handicapped individuals, such as persons with epilepsy, mental retardation, cerebral palsy, and a host of other disabilities, in particular persons with multiple disabilities. In other words, normalization is a rational attempt to deal with the very conditions which have tended to deepen and reinforce prejudice and tended to set the severely handicapped apart from the rest of society. Even natural normalization does not remove all problems, does not create an illusion trouble-free life for the handicapped person. To the contrary, as my use of the word Elysium indicates, only in mythology does one meet up with a state of complete happiness. Normal on our earth is trouble and strife, trial and tribulation, and the handicapped person has a right of being exposed to it. Normalization thus includes the dignity of risk, a concept Robert Kursky brought back from a visit to Denmark and Sweden some years ago. Social psychologists have long discussed that a very useful approach to avoidance is to misunderstand and misapply a concept. And this is what one can observe here. Normalization does not refer to something that is done to people. I certainly don't want to normalize another human being. Normalization refers to facilities and services and situations, indeed to the life situation of a person. It responds to the past and unfortunately still present process of denormalization by trying to reestablish a normal equilibrium. In essence, then, normalization is an effort to effect new and more appropriate patterns of living for handicapped persons, and in particular for those with multiple handicaps. One very striking example of efforts to normalize the environment for handicapped is a very forceful international campaign towards freedom of access. As one travels around in Europe and even in some of the other continents,
beginning in the United States now, one is confronted increasingly with a stylized wheelchair picture indicating that this particular building has no barriers to free access and allows persons in wheelchairs with other physical impediments to enter, to travel to upper stories, use toilets, etc. This freedom of access is a very important tool, and while I realize that opinions differ sharply when it comes to ways of educating the public, in my opinion, freedom of access signs will become a powerful reminder to the general public to think about the handicapped fellow citizens. That should not just apply to the orthopedically handicapped or other non-ambulatory person. I'm sure to protect public attitudes towards all handicapped. Freedom of access leads logically to the problem of housing. Even well-informed, well-motivated colleagues have frequently raised the question, to what extent can severely, multiply handicapped persons live among us? Let me state for myself that to me there is no limit to that if among us refers to the community where we live. Quite specifically, I've always maintained that there is no reason why the most severely handicapped persons presently bedridden in large dormitory institutions could not get very adequate care in specialized nursing facilities right in the community. And we are developed at the moment any number of new appropriate facilities for the individuals. My colleagues ask, will this really bring about good integration? Well, to this I would raise a counter question. Does social integration work out well anywhere for the full range of a non-handicapped population? Why should we demand or expect from the handicapped person what we don't have achieved for the general population? Of the essence in our residential planning, thus must be a continuum, a wide range of domiciliary provisions from the single apartment, not tied to any service or supervisory pattern, to the semi-medical facility, providing a program of rehabilitation nursing with an almost limited list of other types of domiciliary provisions. Here again, normalization is a watchword. Why should any disabled person have to sleep in an unattractive but expensive hospital bed when he can safely sleep in a much cheaper, simple wooden one that can serve as an attractive sofa bed during the day? By the way, it was during a visit I made a good number of years ago in a small Swedish facility for persons with serious involvement in cerebral palsy that this was forcefully brought home to me. In my country, they all are in ugly hospital beds, and there in Sweden, in a specialized facility, they had normal furnishings, and as a result, their whole living style was totally different. They lived a much more human existence. There's no reason why people cannot meet in small groups, even in a large nursing care facility. Why one should not be able to lock one's door room as long as the master key is available from this. If you're interested in what can be done in creating new living spaces for physically severely involved people, the Focus organization in Sweden probably has done the most outstanding job, and I have been. That is being. Taken, and perhaps some of you have already seen the film Like Other People, showing a tender relationship developing between two wheelchair-bound young people affected with cerebral palsy. For me, it was one of the most revealing and most moving experiences, and I also hope that many of you will have an opportunity to read A Right to Love, a report on public and professional attitudes toward the sexual, emotional needs of handicapped people by Anne Shearer, one of England's most gifted social journalists and co-founder of the Campaign for the Mentally Handicapped. What it brought to my mind
was an equally moving vision of the days of Martin Luther King, when black men marched through the streets in American cities holding up a sign proclaiming, "I am a man." Is it not also an aspect of normalization that we shall no longer abrogate the rights of severely, multiply handicapped persons to proclaim and experience the fact, "I am a man, I am a woman"? Gratifying to find now in the professional literature serious discussion with regard to the specific aid we need to give the most severely physically handicapped to achieve a modicum of sexual satisfaction. I have purposely mentioned this area of sexual concern and activity because it is a good place to test our own feelings towards the handicapped person. Before we start checking up on how far others have gone in giving the multiply handicapped adults his due, we ourselves must check how far we have succeeded and how far
we still have to go in according him his individuality,
his dignity, his right to be heard, his right to make decisions affecting him, his right to be a person such as we are. Ladies and gentlemen, I have tried to present to you this evening an
all too selective, all too compressed cross-section of the field of rehabilitation,
from its narrow medical vocational beginnings to the broad-gauge social implications of its present stage of development. Let me close with some words written by Norman Acton, the Secretary General of Rehabilitation International, which again brings us into a wider focus. The world is gradually, too gradually, coming to understand that the
challenge of disability is not reserved to a special few,
but confronts a growing proportion of its people. No family is without need of some of the services provided to supplement physical or mental limitations. The effective delivery of those services is a major economic and social responsibility of each government, far beyond the resources of the individual family. Proper legislation, effectively administered and supported by adequate budgetary provision, is the only rational basis for the fulfillment of this responsibility. In the ideal future, the human rights of every individual will be protected by a society of people whose education and maturity of attitude have eliminated all forms of prejudice and discrimination and assured equal opportunity for all.
Evolution toward that ideal cannot, however, be left to chance.
We must depend on laws to protect human rights and on administrative mechanisms to ensure that the values set forth in the laws are promoted and, if necessary, enforced.
Thank you very much.
As is our custom, Dr. Dibbler will be happy to answer any questions you have to put. My only request is that you make them questions and not commentaries and keep them short.
Boston, a very
charitable group has built a special hospital for children with sperm. Very few with sperm, you know, 60%, 80%. It's just horrible agony. They have a large dormitory where the children are. And on the wall opposite, interview is the
shining medical torture instrument I've ever seen anywhere.
How any architect could be so unfeeling, and how any physician could work in that place without changing it, but just to meet what people were doing. Now, you see, you can need for a child of sperm a lot of special equipment, but you still can put them into a human experience to which
he can relate himself, something from his soul. He had a terrifying experience. You're suddenly moving away, and yet you create a space that completely puts him at a loss. In other words, sure, some people cannot be even in home life atmosphere, but at least you can make it a human as close as possible to what one has experienced. And I think
it would not take much. Unfortunately, we are finally getting architects who are interested more. We are getting international organizations of architects who are beginning to worry about these things now and to create spaces around people. And building, so to speak, now from the inside out our institution around the patient. And what, for instance, worrying about this man in the iron lung, what can we do for him? And he has to be in his place, and he has to surround him. That makes that sense to him. Makes him not part of a machine room, but part of a human existence.
Yes. Yes, could you just... Yes. Do you mind coming down?
Yeah, sure, because they don't want to hear it.
Excuse me. I've been to the United States and seen many, many things in throat work. And the iron lung itself has a great deal of interest for American doctors and, of course, for us too. I've found that they really find things for these people to do, knowing, of course, that when they come out of them, they will find the right things. And one of these things is the written word. Almost everything is done in writing. And the responses are much like you'd watch the goldfish doing his little thing in the goldfish bowl. It's really interesting to know how marvelous these people become in their responses. Thank you very much.
Dr. Dibwad, I'm wondering whether you would discuss, please, the concept of normalization and the problems that many parents of young adolescent mentally retarded people and young adult mentally retarded people have in accepting the normalization and ways of dealing with this.
That's your speech all over again.
Yeah. Well, let me say, first of all, I'm very slow to be critical of parents, even if they assume at the moment a stance, an attitude that is puzzling to me. After all, most of them have been subjected to a barrage of wrong professional advice over many years. A parent who has been told that the child she has born is incapable of any human existence, will never be able to achieve anything, can only be protected, is best taken care of in an institution, of course cannot be expected when adolescent comes to face this with equanimity. To her and to him, every year of additional growth becomes a greater threat, because the baby was acceptable as something strange, but as this person begins to grow, keeps on growing. So I have sympathy, and I've always been willing to sit down with parents rather patiently. But on the other hand, for those fortunate parents who have had guidance from the very beginning, that this is a human being, see, this is not a retarded child, this is a child with some difficulty, who is much more like than unlike other people, and I would say this for even the most severely handicapped, and we are finding it more and more, and this is a child who needs to be brought up in the main like other children. The basic things, acceptance of limitations, developing appropriate relations with other human beings and so on, is very essential. Your reference to, let me be a little audacious, your reference to adolescent, of course, means S-E-X. Well, you see, those parents who from the very beginning have pointed up to their children that boys are boys and girls are girls, and that we have certain conventions in human life, and that after a certain age, nowadays we don't wait too long, you close the door when you go to the toilet, and you don't run around without clothes, and you happen to be at the beach, and you don't go around hugging and kissing, and you don't send your child to a school where teachers hug and kiss a 6 and 7 and 8 year old boy when this is obviously no longer appropriate for him, and so on. If you look after those things, I think you can move into, or move with the child into adolescence with a good bit of equanimity. Certainly, we have tens of thousands of adolescent, severely mentally handicapped youngsters travel through our cities in North America, I think that in Canada just as much as the United States, with a minimum of incidents. They seem to be far better able to handle themselves than we thought this was possible. And I certainly want to give help to parents. I certainly realize, I come back to what I said, why should we expect from handicapped people, mentally handicapped people, what we don't expect from normal adolescents? Adolescence is a period of change, of a little crisis, of confusion, and so on. But I would feel that parents who have had the proper backing by professional counselors should be able to handle this adolescent period. If you have any hidden specific question, I wish you would be more specific, and I'll try to be more specific.
I was thinking of a couple of issues, one that has come up recently, and that is the right for the mentally retarded young adult to drink if he is over drinking age. Mm-hmm. And the other is the problem of the mentally retarded young adult being able and being permitted to transport himself throughout the city and to make decisions for himself instead of us making decisions for them, for him or her, and pretending that he's made the decisions.
Well, I don't know of any law in Canada or in the United States that keeps a mentally retarded adolescent of the age when you are allowed to go and buy a bottle of beer, to go and buy one. I hope that he has had good enough education so he knows whatever caused a bottle of beer. I'm not an expert on the field of alcohol consumption, but in any case, if he knows the coins he needs to have, he can go in and get himself a bottle of beer. I would hope that in his home, he and his other non-handicapped siblings have learned behavior patterns vis-a-vis alcoholic beverages as a, you know, as part of the education we would have in any family. Transporting himself around the community, certainly in any decent school for, we're talking about severely handicapped because mildly they do it anyhow, in any decent self-respecting school for severely handicapped people, travel training, including physically handicapped, is of course one of the main points of teaching. How one gets on and off a bus and where one pays and all these things, just as much as you teach them use a telephone. And now when you talk about driver training, that's a little bit more difficult because there you deal with a bureaucracy to which we in most, certainly in the United States, have given a lot of authority. They can very quickly, even when I have glasses, say that with those glasses I never can drive without the glass or with the glass, whatever he wants to do. So driver licensing, I tell you, is a little bit difficult, but I know certainly of individuals in the United States who have been in institutions for mentally retarded and are now driving motor cars. They're usually good, careful, slow drivers. But so I think what you're talking about is the acceptance in the community of the retarded young people. We see them now in stores and we see them elsewhere, just as we now have accepted the severely physically handicapped people and make room for them. Somewhere you and I are not communicating.
Yeah, okay. I think I'm missing one thing, and this is the acceptance of the parents themselves of the mentally handicapped young person, be he adult or adolescent, to do these activities. This is where the problem frequently seems to lie. Professionals in the field are willing to work on a normalization program. These young people are 20 years old now, so they haven't had 20 years of normalization behind them. Now, how do we help both the parent and the young person to deal with this?
Let me say that you maybe have met an unusual number of parents who are unwilling to give them the freedom. I have met an unusual number of professional people who are putting up the barrier. But in any case, I think this is why I talked about the dignity of risk. Any handicapped person, I mention it not just with mentally, any handicapped person should be given the risk to move about and so on. And I think in our better training facilities and so on, that is certainly coming very much to the fore now.
One more question.
Dr. Dibot, I have one question. In my survey of some of the statistics on the mental retarded in many countries, I found that in so-called developed countries, or where the educational facilities are good and many people attend, many children attend the schools, the rates of mental retarded was highest. Up to 14, 15 years of age, and then suddenly drop. And in those developing countries where the facilities are not widespread, and so not all the children attend the schools, the rate of mental retardation were relatively low all through, and so there's no peaking of this mental retarded at the age of after the age of 14, 15, and there's no drop, sudden drop. From this phenomenon, we can see that the mental retardation is also a phenomenon of education. It's an artificial, possibly created criteria. We may be labeling patients, labeling children who don't do well in the schools as mentally retarded. And yet, when they go out of the school, they function fairly well in the society. Now, though in your worldwide experience, what have you found those children who have been labeled as mentally retarded in the schools, and then what happened to them? Whether this labeling might be might have done something libelous to these children in their future social adjustment.
I certainly agree with your observation. You might be interested that an official American governmental agency once published a booklet about the six-hour retarded child. Meaning the large number of children who are considered by the public school to be retarded and are treated in a childish way, quite inappropriate for their age, treated like little children, and who at the end of the school day go home back to the neighborhood and are engaged in activities that would make their teachers blush. Worldwide, and they may not always be socially the most acceptable activities, but they are perfectly competent social human beings who find their way around, who lead a very active life in the community, but there are school problems. And I certainly agree with you that we have labeled a large number of individuals and treating in our schools a large number of individuals as retarded, who indeed are not. If you want to get a shocker, let me say that about a year ago, a young student of mine introduced me to a young woman who was studying linguistics at Wellesley College, one of our very fine Massachusetts women's colleges, and a very attractive young lady, pleasing to look at for an old man. And after about 10 minutes of conversation, it suddenly came about, because you know my interest, that she had spent 7 years in a class for retarded children in the great city of Los Angeles. And be it said to the shame of the city of Los Angeles and its school systems, because she had a Spanish-sounding surname. And thereby, it was simply assumed that she was a backward child. And for 7 years, she was kept. As you know, this is not an isolated experience. And so I want to emphasize to you, Dr. Lin, that indeed I am fighting against labeling. I feel that this is a process that has been indeed damaging to children, and that we should be much more careful how we designate children, that we have used the intelligence test in a pernicious way. We have destroyed children by the careless use of designation of IQs without any consideration when the test was taken, who was giving it, what the competence was of the person giving it, and so on. And this has nothing to do with the proper use of testing by qualified people. But the labeling of children is something that in the most recent years, two books have appeared within 1 year by very distinguished scholars in my own country. The labeling of individuals has been a pernicious way, and unfortunately, schools have been very much guilty of this. And I hope that we will, under the guidance of what you tell your teachers and what professors of education teach students nowadays, I hope that we will move away from this convenience of putting labels on people which are damaging to them. That's a nice benediction.
Thank you, Dr. Goodwood. I'm going to ask Dr. Cates if he will express the thanks of the meeting.
Thank you, good Lord, ladies and gentlemen. My privilege on behalf of the Institute.
Very much interested in following their planning. It might be said that in no area